Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, we've taken a field trip. Today, we're in Tarrytown, New York, at Stone Barns Agricultural Center, speaking with Jack Algier, the farm director. Hey, Jack, how you doing?
Hey, Aaron, I'm doing great. Thanks for coming all the way out here.
It is my pleasure, Jack. And as I'm going to tell our listening audiences, we are sharing a microphone. So there will be a bit of a transition between our passing the mic, but that's okay. It'll be like a more of a live situation. I'm very excited by this opportunity for us to be sitting in this very unique place, which, Jack, I'm guessing, though, after a while, you know, just it's you've been doing this for a while here at Stone Barns. But when I show up here, and it's like coming to Disneyland. It's a pretty special place. I feel enthused and seeing this type of epicenter here developing around the future of food systems and agriculture. So what I'd love for you to do is maybe share a little bit about Stone Barns, a little bit of the history, when your involvement took place. And yeah, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you don't lose that day-to-day experience when you're here and you still can take it all in and realize what a special place this is. But if you'd share a little bit with our listening audience about where you're lucky enough to come to work every day.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking that. And actually, I do feel very lucky to come to work at a place like this and to have my life and work sort of around this beautiful place. So I'll start with that you know, I kind of dedicated my life to farming. I knew I wanted to do that very early in my life, at least growing things and raising animals, raising plants, and I realized that I wanted to grow food for people shortly after realizing that I had the skill sets to grow and take care for things. And really that comes from the idea of working in beautiful environments, working in natural systems, having space between people in a work environment is also just a great thing. Working with the environment plays so much in our mood, in our relationships. And so I've farmed in a number of different places around the country. I would say that all of them were cared for environments, you know, live, organic, biodynamic, beautiful, cared for farms. But I remember thinking about coming here when I was first asked to come take a look at this place and see if I would be interested in coming to potentially manage and start this farm back in 2003. And I thought, you know, we're here in Westchester County, which is a very populated county and a very affluent county. I had thought that agriculture had pretty well left this county from my perspective where I was and grew up in Rhode Island. And always thought, well, there's such a populated space, how could there really be farmland still in this area? And I remember coming out here for the first time with a little bit of skepticism in my mind, thinking, you know, maybe this is just an estate or something. And I was just blown away by the natural beauty of this particular place here on the Hudson River. We're about 500 feet in elevation on these sort of twin mountain peaks over about 2 miles away from the Hudson River in view of it, in an area that is surrounded by about 2,000 acres of preserved forest land, and we have about 350 plus acres of beautiful open pasture with oak savanna. The hawks were flying, the breeze was blowing the clouds across the sky, the river was shimmering, and I thought, this could be okay. I think maybe I could stick around here for a little while and see if we couldn't get this place going. You know, one thing about farming is that it makes it a lot easier to farm in a place that has not been trashed by people or ruined. You know, and Wendell Berry would say, you know, there are no unsacred places. There are only desecrated places. You know, and this place is truly cared for and has been sacred for its existence. So to come onto a piece of property here that we're on a place that is high ground, big valley land, rocky, hence the stone barns. We have a 49,000 square foot stone barn complex that we're in right now that was built from the rock in our soils. The granite, the schist, the gneiss that makes up our soil is right here. And on top of that is this beautiful soil that's been managed by first the Dutch in the 1600s all the way through to the Rockefeller family at the turn of the century. These barns were built in 1930 as a dairy for John D. Rockefeller Jr.'s family. And the property had a few lives gone through as a dairy and then as a bit of a storage space for cars and odds and ends. And then Peggy Rockefeller in 1970 started a Simmental breeding operation out of these barns. We can thank and credit Peggy Rockefeller for starting American Farmland Trust and having a lot of love and care for agriculture and conservation as they connect with each other. And the Rockefeller family as a whole has done a lot to preserve state and national parklands. Obviously, there's that love and care for land preservation. So I love the juxtaposition, this relationship between agriculture center like this and preserve space, and now what Stone Barn Center Food and Agriculture has become out of this. Peggy Rockefeller died in 1996, and her husband David Rockefeller wanted to keep the legacy of her life in relation to her love for agriculture and memorialize that by and through the influence of his daughter, Peggy Delaney, to start a nonprofit. So in the process of designing that nonprofit, they brought a board of people together. They searched for a restaurant partner through Blue Hill, Dan and David Loreen. They searched for a farmer, myself. We had a great group of advisory board members and family members that were engaged in really kicking the place off, getting it started. You know, well-endowed start financially, but more importantly, with experience and wisdom, the people that were here to help start this thing started with a great intention, which is just as much beauty as the landscape of this place was the great intention of what this organization meant to do, which is a very simple thing. It's just to connect people to food and agriculture and redevelop the culture that we've so lost. And we're a physical place, and we're also a philosophical mindset. And so we can play in both of those places, and we can use the environment that we have, which is our immediate 90 acres here, is a working, operating, diversified agroecological system, vegetable fields, half acre of soil, greenhouses, pasture land with sheep, cattle, goats, pigs, chickens, ducks, turkeys, geese, bees, just very diversified. We're doing all kinds of seed work. We have a big composting operation. We do waste feeding systems. We're constantly in innovation and academic partnerships, restaurant partnerships, engineering partnerships. And on top of all that, we're training students and young farmers and the public at large and professionals. And it is just an incredible platform for learning and sharing. And I think really kind of a one-of-a-kind place. It's really turned itself into from that very simple intention.
That was wonderful. That was a great overview and description. I think one of the areas that folks should also know is one of the other, you had mentioned numerous different crops, orchard, pulses, grains, ground crops, greenhouses. You also have a significant amount of free-range New Yorkers coming in here, and you have quite a bit of agrotourism happening, both because of Blue Hills, but because of the educational infrastructure you have associated to that. So as the individual that has to manage and operate or deal with an operational farm, to deal with a multidimensional farm, how do you make sense of all of this? And if you please share with the audience what you do to make sense of that. And then also, how do you push the envelope? Because as you mentioned, you do have the opportunity to stand on the shoulders of some giants here within food and ag. And so I would guess for you that it puts a bit of burden on you to continue to push the envelope and to look at how you can cast this shadow of what's being created here to a broader audience that's also focused on regenerative agriculture and giving back to the land and better appreciation of awareness and holism with what's happening with our land, our soils, and our environment.
Well, I think you're getting at a really important aspect of this work, and really around impact and meaning of what we're able to do. Because, of course, any kind of privilege, when a community is really working well, like we are, I would call that a bit of a privilege. The world that we're in is has all sorts of difficulties and diversity in it, and I would say we are very well off to have an environment of people around us that are so caring and so able and wise about the use of the resources that we have. So the biggest responsibility I think that I have is to make what we're doing most impactful, because it's not about how much resources we have to do something well, it's how we use those resources, right? And so I look at that as the people I work with, that we want to inspire curiosity, we want to inspire innovation, and we want to stay on that live edge and make the best use of the resources that we actually have at our hand. There's a great graph of agroecology, of the concept of agroecology and what it means, that was developed from IFOAM and really given to the UN in 2015. I use this graph often. It looks like a big U with an arrow, and on an axis that goes from high productivity to high sustainability. And the world of industrial agriculture as it is this very high productivity and low sustainability place, but it's also very isolating. Centralized, focused, large, singular, all of those kind of adjectives are for that. And what that creates is a lot of poverty and disempowerment and scarcity, all the things that come with that. So we want to get to a place where there's real sustainability, but for us to just go straight across and get to that place is just not a reality. What has to happen is because we have this kind of false scaffolding under us of non-renewable resources and debt and all these things that are there, if we really want to get out of that, we need to take that jump together. And that requires a bit of a fall, a fall in productivity for a bit. And often people are not ready to take that risk. What that little spot there means is that we're not willing to innovate. We're not willing to take that risk, even though it might actually end up in being something better and more regenerative. Mm-hmm. So what does it take for you to do that and your family? What does it take for us as a community to do that? Generally, it takes confidence of others around us to say, oh, well, I'll be there with you. If you take this jump, I'm there. Well, let's do that. Let's do this together. And then what starts to happen is the accumulation of communities, and of once you start doing generative things and, you know, caring for the soil and caring for the ecology, caring for the things other than just the productive bottom line, and care for all of the other values that are around us, then all of the other trades and all of the other professions and backgrounds and skill sets and traditions come in. And that's where we end up in a place that is sustainable and productive. And that happens on a global scale by, including all of the peasants and including all of these things and not just trying to overshadow. And we see that happening in countries across the world where dropping food on places is not solving the problem, but teaching people how to use generative practices and design, build their community cultures back again is what's making change and helping to feed these communities. Not that we feed the world, but that we help to encourage the change that needs to happen with everyone, that empowerment. So I'd say that's kind of in our little nucleus here. We have this great group of people that inspires a bit of risk and innovation. And when I look at the farmers and other people that are coming here in the public, we have such a broad spectrum of people that come to this place. Some people who haven't stepped on grass in a while, and some people who are really, like yourself, deeply engaged. And the entire spectrum in between, chefs, engineers, teachers, the whole spectrum, everyone connects to food. And everyone can make that connection to the natural system. Yeah. So what we're really trying to do is get people to recognize that we all have a relationship. So when we get people on these grounds, there are really big topics and there are real urgent things going on, but we want to make sure that we're entering this conversation not from the deepest complexity and the difficulty of this whole thing, but the pleasure of it. Mm. Like, how does this enrich your life by showing up and being in this beauty and being in a system that's healthy and that's collaborative and has that sense of generation, that curiosity that, there's something else we can learn from this. Because people get inspired by that and they may think that, they leave here, just be a little more awake about how they purchase their food or how they're giving themselves time to make dinner. These are not extravagant acts. These are cultural developments. And we want to inspire those things. And so, we do have this very complex farm system here. One of the ways that I kind of look at it is, in general, as a holistic design, that the farm is a single organism. Mm-hmm. It's a working place. The people that are here are part of that, too. And it's really important that every piece of this farm, every little thing that we're doing, whether it's a pig enterprise, waste-fed, forest-raised pigs, or ducks on pasture, or sheep on cover crop fields, or grain in pasture fields, and these mixed systems that we're doing, they're complex in their own right, but really they're artifacts to a single whole thinking. Mm-hmm. And that's the way that I get through all this stuff, because it's really just a set of very basic principles. There are the nature principles that Sir Albert Howard and that he would talk about in the 40s. There's, the world is not a sustainable place without soil. Mm-hmm. And biodiversity is a key to the health of the system, including the relationship of animals and ecosystems. Our water and land base is just as valuable. Our wild spaces are just as valuable resources as our agricultural production spaces, and that there really isn't such thing as waste. Mm. That if we look at it closely enough, everything is a usable, recyclable, renewable thing. And we use those as principles, those four kind of tenets as the decision-making tools. Mm. And from that, we say stewardship essentially is, stewardship is not a thing you do. It's a way that you connect the innovations and the methods and breeds and practices and all these things that you're doing and how you tie them and work with those natural cycles. And our whole team is really committed to that. And we, not only the farm team, but our teachers and our office staff and our chefs, they know these principles, and they understand that every step we take at this place is with those intentions. So having lots of people here, some of the complexity of having 100,000, 150,000 people a year on your farm may seem really overwhelming. Especially for farmers out there, because we know how autonomous, and you know, we're farmers because we like to be away from lots of people, not necessarily in a city environment. And sometimes this place can feel really populated. But, you know, I think, first off, I'm super inspired by the young team of people that I have working with me. And they're not all young by age, but they're young by heart and by mind, and they're a creative group of people. And I'd say there are a lot of young farmers coming into this place and cycling through. To me, that adds so much more inspiration to this, like the fact that there are people coming in and going out and starting new ventures from this place and bringing ideas in and sharing those ideas and bringing them out. It's really what the place, that's why it's great to have so many people come to the farm, because doing it in a bubble, I felt a long time ago, wasn't making enough change. That one of the things I've always thought that Stone Barns was, right from the beginning, was an amplifier. Mm. So, obviously, you can make a real lot of ugly noise with an amplifier, but you can also feed a lot of people with that.
Yeah, you had started the conversation by talking about systems thinking, and to your point about amplification, you know, it can create great harmony. And when you can add that harmony to where people are connecting more with their food or their natural environment, that can have huge impact. And I think that's why we've adopted a term of describing you as being an epicenter. You can really showcase some of these advancements and the commitments that you're speaking of your staff, of the commitment to the land, to the ecology, and to doing it the right way and not compromising that can show that it can be done properly and to those principles, following those principles, and that's very exciting. You had mentioned, and I want to ask you this, is so you're now a decade into your young farmers program here at Stone Barns, which I think has been a very, from my understanding, very successful approach. And you said people come in often and they're launching new ventures out of Stone Barns. Could you share with our audience what the young farmers program is and maybe a couple anecdotal stories of some of the folks that you've met and some of the neat things that you've seen come out of this?
So the Young Farmers Program here really started as like a basic apprentice program. And actually, you could say it started even before that, because the people that were really coming to want to work with me were not coming off of small farms or something to want to continue. Anybody who was doing that was already at their, you know, parents' farm or something. So generally speaking, the kind of folks that were coming here and kind of people who were interested in the food system and are really first-generation farmers for the most part. And so they're coming, they're life changers. They're coming out of environmental science. They're coming out of engineering. They're coming out of some pre-med. There's a whole range of stuff that, but generally creative and definitely inspired to do something directly, to make change directly in the world. And that's what got them to shift to farming. Some of them, you know, I hear the same story over and over for years, a very similar story from a lot of people. Like, I wasn't making enough change in the work that I was doing. I got through college and started to work in this particular industry, and I realized that I was doing something that wasn't feeding my soul. And I thought, I'm young enough, I can make that change. I want to go grow food and, you know, take that risk. You know, even though I owe a lot of money to school and my parents suggested that I shouldn't do this, you know, that used to be the story. It's not quite the same story anymore, and I will get to that. Because actually, I think that people, especially now, there's a lot more encouragement of parents or their kids to do this sort of stuff post-college or even pre-college, to get a connection, to find meaning in the work that they're doing. And what I found right away is that these groups came in, and there's numbers of younger folks, early 20s, mid-20s, that would come and say, you know, I'm going to leave this other life behind so I can learn how to farm. And there's a lot of things I would say that helps growing up with a mechanical background and with a relationship to nature. I think that that kind of soul-centric lifestyle helps if you're going to farm, because there's a lot of new things to relearn. Right? The patterning has to change for you to get into this kind of groove, the kind of physical work that's necessary, and finding the joy in that kind of physical work and efficiency with your body and mimicry and all those things that are relative to physical outdoor work like this. So they would come, and I would also say to them, you know, whatever you were doing in the past, tell me about your work that you did in the past. And try to find some metaphor to what you were doing and how you can apply that, especially to the kind of work you're doing. You're not leaving the rest of the world to come and farm. You're farming with the skills of the world, of this modern time. So if you were working on the stock exchange, or you were working in an engineering firm, or you were on a basketball team, you still have great skill sets to bring to this work, right? And that's the thing we wanted to encourage, that this is not some other kind of world here, that this is very much a modern kind of lifestyle in a way that's actually really generative for the other kinds of works that their peers may be doing. And I think it's really inspiring for others. And so what we find is that the dreamer a little bit comes in and wants to immediately grow food and learn how to do all this stuff. And then they realize that the physical work is a lot on their bodies, and they have a lot to learn about how to care for themselves and how to care for plants and how to think about whole systems and how to be okay with being in all weather conditions and getting muddy and manure-y and whatever it is, you know. And it doesn't stick for everybody. And, you know, sometimes I remember having a conversation with one of our apprentices earlier on, and he came to me, and he would often grunt a lot. He'd be working, and he just overly labored himself. Every time he pushed a hoe or something, it was always three times as much work as he needed to be putting into that. We try to tell the team, if they're using hand tools, to dance, to have posture, to think Fred Astaire, not so much caveman. We're standing up, we're upright. This is precision work. This is live. We have the tools to be precise, and we have the methodology to have our accurate moments and be out there, systematic stuff. And I think we do a really good job at that, and that's what we train for, is how them get them to understand the cycles and rhythms of nature and their bodies. That's a sort of modern farmer, really, especially a small-scale farmer, because they're not on machines a lot. They're often on their feet and using their hands. It's a different kind of work. So I had this young man come to me, and he said, you know, I think I'd be better as a manager. It's like, well, you know, I was like, that's an interesting thing, because, you know, the thing about being a manager is you really need to be empathetic to the work that everybody's doing. You need to understand that and know that you have to understand it to the depth that you can help somebody through this process. You're going to tell them what to do, so it better be something efficient, or they're going to really resent you for it. You know, there's a lot of things. So, you know, and he ended up not continuing to farm as an example, but he's a passionate guy. He eats well. He shifted his life into a place like that. Other guys that have, men and women, actually, in fact, I would say that about 70% of folks who have come through apprenticeships have been women. I just mentioned that because I think this is, it's great empowered work. And mixed gender, very open communication kind of work. It's very social. it's not something that is people think of agriculture as really hard work, but small scale diversified work, whether that's animals or vegetables, I think actually is smart and efficient work and doesn't need to be sort of brutal. Like, I think that often people imagine it to be that way. It can be long, but long is not necessarily exhausting. You know, the crews work together well. They have such camaraderie. And as the years have gone on with the apprentice groups, there's these cohorts, these people that our alumni group of apprentices that keep coming back, with hundreds of people that have worked with us over the years, and they still come back, and many of them have farms of their own, have hired on apprentices that we've had after the fact, that while they were here, just deeply questioned what we were doing. I love that fresh, that idea. As a manager, my perspective as the director of this space is to manage in a way that is highly open communication, that I want to hear from everyone to speak, at the same time them to know that not everything changes when you speak, but it influences everything. Mm-hmm. And so when we get into that kind of mode, I think often people learn more from the mistakes and realize that often people will come to want to train in a place and they think they're going to learn from perfection. And the reality is, you never learn from perfection. You learn from all the mistakes, mm-hmm. and all the imperfections of nature. And you learn how to be accepting and creative and problem solving and all these things that come up of that. And the best people that have come through that program and gone off to do their own things and be successful are the ones that really made that shift of thinking, that recognized the places that weren't perfect and acted on that to try to change it with me. Mm. It's probably been the most interesting thing. In fact, some of my best apprentices have come back to work with me as perennial managers, and for that I'm grateful and have a great relationship with.
I think that's a testament to you and what you've been able to create then, and also how to pass that knowledge upon these younger farmers. It is an iterative process. It's a bit like being an entrepreneur. It's not right for everyone. You learn as you go. You pick it up and you continue. And I think many people would define the original farmers as being the first entrepreneurs. I mean, you have to figure out so many different things. You have many variables, many different attributes going on in at once. So let's jump back to your background. You had mentioned that you're originally from Rhode Island. You'd always been interested in organic and biodynamic ecological agriculture, I think since the 90s. So what was your influence in food and ag, and what made you cultivate that? What made you explore that?
Well, my background with this is my parents homesteaded in Rhode Island. So I grew up on a farm. My father was had a Votec background. He taught automotive repair and shop and all that sort of stuff for high school, and also had a drafting company and built kitchens and things like that for restaurants and things. And my mother's a very avid gardener. And so we had all sorts of animals, and, you know, cows and goats and pigs and chickens and big vegetable gardens and flower gardens and that sort of thing. So just having that growing up in that environment, I would say it wasn't that got me thinking about growing food, but it was that gave me a background of tinkering around in barns and spending a lot of time in the woods by myself and paying attention to the natural system around me. I think I would give more credit to that than pretty much anything. It's just that there was a foundation set. Later, the interest from all this stuff came, actually my parents moved from that farm. I took on a job working in these greenhouses for a man named Bud Smith. And Bud was a Korean War veteran and a multi-generational greenhouse grower. Had been growing in these beautiful redwood, glass redwood houses and big tunnels and that kind of stuff. And this was back in the early 90s. And it was at that point where there was still, the nursery business was still happening, but it was kind of close to the end. This is when the small nurseries in everybody's town that you can remember still had that kind of post-war loyalty to them. Like every family, for every holiday, every church, always buying, you know, we could pretty well set up how many poinsettias and Easter lilies we're going to sell for the year, how many geraniums for the flower boxes at the beach houses. We knew everyone who was going to show up at the door of that place. And I mean, that's a really beautiful loyalty. A lot of the plants we grew ourselves from seeds. We grew a lot of nursery stock and vegetable stock. And even in the time I was there in high school, we started to shift towards buying in flats from bigger companies. And the first box stores started to emerge. And the price of a poinsettia at those box stores was a third of the cost. And, you know, with obvious lower quality. But the loyalty was diminishing also. And I thought, you know, here I am in these spaces. And, you know, I started those greenhouses, the old timers that worked in this greenhouse were had a great understanding of organics, but we used a lot of chemical spray. And I remember having a lot of questions about that, always asking about why we weren't using more natural methods. And I said, well, you know, we have to, for us to keep up with the quality in like this, we need to use this. That's the old days. And I remember one day we got this rot on these geraniums that were all tissue cultured, and we had, you know, seven greenhouses full of geraniums, so tens of thousands of them. And, you know, Bud said, oh, there's black rot on these things. You have to spray this fungicide on all these things. And, you know, so put on the suit and tape up, you know, tape your wrist, tape your mask on your face, and go in there and spray for this. And I thought, why would we have to spray everything? There's just like five plants in here. He's like, well, no, once it shows up, you know, it's an epidemic there. It's all tissue. And I said, you know, why is it that we're doing this? You know that this isn't a sustainable thing to do. And he's like, well, that's what the customer wants. The customer wants pink geraniums. So they're not really interested in kale. You know, and so he's like, this is how this business works. And I thought, you know, I went through this whole house and sprayed this whole house with this fungicide. And I thought, you know, I entered this work thinking that I was doing something good by being a grower, a gardener. And here I am, you know, I'm not helping anybody in this. I'm not helping myself. I'm not helping the business. I'm not helping the customer or the environment. And I had such high hopes for this kind of work. And, you know, I thought, all right, I got to figure out where this problem is. I got to figure out how to make change here, because I feel pretty much powerless at this moment. And so I went to school, decided to shift from actually going to school for music. I went to school for plant science, studied plant science at the University of Rhode Island. And while I was there, I realized that, you know, essentially, you know, I had a great education at URI, but I realized that a lot of that thinking came from the university settings. And and like any good, you know, independently minded 19-year-old, I said, you know what, I don't believe this. I'm going to push against this. And that's when I realized that actually food is the way to make change for people, to get them to understand this stuff. Not just growing anything, but growing something that people are going to consume. Because they weren't making the connection with the geranium, but they do make the connection with food. If it's not for themselves, it's for their child. And I thought, I'm good at this. And I love to grow anything. So let's focus on vegetables. Let's focus on soils. And let's just begin. And at the time, my wife now and partner for 24 years, Shannon, and I had just begun our relationship and started farming together at a biodynamic operation close by, and really never looked back. We just have traveled a lot of places, grown food for a number of different communities, and have been very fortunate in anywhere we've been really to have extraordinary mentors, elder mentors, and that have given us the confidence and really stood behind us and said, yeah, keep going, you know, including my parents. And, you know, I think that makes a world of difference when you have someone in your life who you admire, but also admires you for what you do. And I would say that kind of has given back to me here. And, you know, sometimes I really do believe that you can manifest things that happen for yourself. If you want things to happen, you really can put it out there and work for it. And, you know, you never know how it's going to really emerge. But I said I wanted my voice to be heard in this stuff. I don't just want to do this in the back country. I want to make a difference. And actually, one of my old mentors, Amigo Condesano, California, after leaving California, working there for several years in the olive business and vegetables, he called me up and he said, hey, you know what? There's this farm up in Westchester, and I heard all about this thing, and they really need somebody good, and you need to do this. So you go check it out. And that was the beginning. I wasn't looking for something new, but the bell rang. And honestly, this is like, it really is emerged as a thing that gives me the chance to give back some of that I had in my younger years. I had real mentors. They weren't, you know, it's an interesting thing to talk about young farmers and training programs and all the things that we're trying to do in the world to help get people engaged in this kind of thing. The one little bit of magic that's hard to create is that mentors are partners. And I'm realizing that the more I go, and I've realized that by having the mentors that I have, that it's not only the younger that receives, it's that the elder, it's a cycle that happens. You realize that you're passing something, you realize that you are able to share something that this person is appreciating. It's a great loop. And I think it has always been this sort of really secret ingredient of good agriculture.
More part of that systems thinking again, quite interesting. And I love the analogy that you expressed of the horticultural world in the nurseries of the 90s, similar to what we're seeing almost in the adverse effect now going towards the local food movement, where we're going back to supporting our local farmers and becoming more aware. But you brought up an interesting point there, and you're saying Bud, who ran the was it Bud? Yeah. And Bud in his greenhouse would spray the fungicide because that's the way it was done, right? I mean, if that's what the customers want, that's what we're going to do, without thought of, well, what does this represent for you or for other workers, or really what does that mean on that fungicide that sits on that tissue and eventually is breathed in by those kids that are looking at that poinsettia? So those are all questions that have become more light, and I think we've become more aware of the situation. So that leads me to my last question I want to ask you, Jack, which is around, so you sit on the board of Johnny Select Seeds, and recently Dan Barber launched a seed company here called Row 7 Seeds. These seeds focusing on not just heirloom, but really progressing, you know, man's responsibility in this can have some manipulation, but it's using nature as our line of demarcation, where we're looking at RNA as the ability to, you know, keeping thing within kingdoms of plants. So we're not adding a transgenesis approach to engineering crops. We're keeping things as a cisgenesis. We're keeping within the same kingdom. And, But my question for you with regards to that is, seeds have become a bit of a ground zero for the impetus of a food fight. And often who's left in the middle are the farmers. Because similar to your point of what happened in the horticultural world or within that greenhouse, it's just the way it's been done. Or you've inherited a farm that has been using this system, this approach, this model for agriculture and many of that models are based off the seeds that you use and the practices that are set forth from that. So how can we deal with that increasing pressure on our farmers? Because now they're getting market pressure from consumers that want them to go to an adverse or a different realm. And what are some of the best approaches that you've seen for moving us in a direction that can bridge those gaps and bridge the middle?
I think that a farmer is able to gain power in what they're doing and a voice in their community when they're able to connect with those individuals that the customer directly. I think that's what gets lost is there's a lot of advertisement and there's a lot of different parts of the food system that have benefited from the local, the organic, the sort of conscious food movement that's arrived. Often the farmer is the last to benefit from that movement because we're parting shares. So every time it grows, we're cutting another pie for another part of the profession, a new profession, a broker, an app, a facility. You know, we're rebuilding the structure. So the prices are not necessarily changing for the farmer. And so as this whole thing changes, as new businesses engage to help take the pressure off the farmers and get them to focus on that work, that's how we'll start to see some of the value return to them. Is that, you know, farmers for a long time have been forced to do everything. And now in the process of the benevolence, I guess, is something that's sort of arriving, is that other people really do want to help the food system. So they engage in different ways to try to back that farmer up, make it easier for them to do these things. That transition is a hard transition, though, because farmers are having to relearn what their real function is in the system. They've been doing this very autonomously for a long time. So there's a real value in what that is for this scale, because it's a really small population compared to the amount of people that are going to need to change the food system, right? The farmer is still going to be a small percentage of that pie, even though I would hope that we get, you know, millions, tens of millions more farmers. It's still going to be a small number when we're talking about hundreds of millions of people eating. So first is finding that relationship to understanding and enjoyment. So that's the direct relationship to chefs, either in restaurants, fine dining chefs, but also getting people back in the kitchen and cooking, right? This is our best education, is self-educating through consumption, the eating, cooking, engaging with the food itself, and recognizing the difference in all the different senses that we relate to these things, not just as a finished product, but in the process of development. What makes a chef extraordinary is that the chefs are working with the product all the way through the process, not just the end product, but the way they touched it all the way through and the way they've respected that thing as it left the farm. And we look at that. We follow what we work with all the way to the end with everything that we work with as a principle, whether that's through our CSA members or public or Blue Hill or chefs, that we want to follow it. It's part of the sort of wholeness of this place to do that. That's not possible for everyone. So often what happens is farmers lose value every time it gets left. It leaves their hand and they lose the sight of the end use. Spend all this time developing this thing and then it's not appreciated and it leaves their hand, or as certain values aren't appreciated, right? Maybe just economics, or maybe just the very surface of a sustainability piece. So the way I think that we can develop that is to recognize what the true value of farming as a whole is. It's often just recognized as farmers grow food and that's the function, right? But what we're really talking about is stewards. These agriculture as conservation is a very important thing to consider here. especially in the light of all the different kinds of agriculture that are emerging to help defend our culture, mostly around climate change. You know, the planet will be fine, but we may not be. So our practices need to change. And I think that I think embracing science is a really valuable thing, but understanding the function and using it in the correct way is tricky, right? So I'm an advocate for soil systems and holistic design in the way that I believe that agriculture is a net positive for land conservation, that it's active conservation that I've seen in the decades of work that I participated, essentially in my life of working in agriculture. I've witnessed land improved by staying and growing food on it and feeding the communities that are there. I've witnessed forests change. I've witnessed pastures improve and vegetable fields get more productive. And I see it as a working potential for the future. I really have seen it. And I've seen it not just by my hand, but more importantly by lots of other people doing a great thing, doing good farming. So I know that there's hope in that respect. But I also know that there are other methods and things popping up, like all of the hydroponic designs and things that are happening in urban centers and the efficiencies of those things. I don't necessarily consider those generative in the way that soil systems are, but they have a capacity to be sustainable and low resource. And there's value in those. And what they're growing in there, those technologies are going to keep getting better. And I hope become more complementary to the soil type systems that are happening. And I also hope that in the plant science, transgenic, GMO world, that those kind of sciences, that we start to relate them back to systems and ideas that actually help to improve capacity. I love to work with plant genetics and animal genetics because I believe that everything's new all the time. And every time a seed is born off a plant and every time an animal is born, they are new. It may be an heirloom, but it's new and it has adapted to the environment that it was just in. And whether it's a 1,000-year-old corn or a brand new, the thing is you have to be able to replicate it. And it should be in the hand of the people. There are very few things that we inherit in this world, and genetics is one of them. And to lose that would be a real tragedy in the world. So it's more important to me that people have the capacity to maintain and generate the inheritance of plant genetics and animal genetics, and that our sciences are used to reinforce that. Maybe we'll get there at some point. I think we're in tumultuous moment with all that in large industrial agriculture because there's so much investment in that needs to be recovered. Right, so it gets a little bit stingy. But we can only look ahead and think that if people know more about the food system and ask for more and demand more as a consumer, we'll change the food system together. And where do we learn that stuff? On the small farms that you can access, because we recognize that we come to a beautiful place, because really, I know hundreds of great small farmers, and they all live in beautiful places, and they're all around everybody who's listening.
That was great insight, Jack. Thank you very much. And yeah, I mean, how lucky are we that we've got things like hybrid vigor, that, you know, nature gives us a little boost every time we do want to work with genetics on the natural order. So, Jack, if our listeners were interested in partaking in a young farmers program, or if they wanted to come enjoy some of the fruits of your hard labor here in the field and want to come out to Blue Hills, or if they want to be one of the 150,000 potential tourists that you have here at Stone Barns, where can they learn more about what you're up to here at Stone Barns?
Well, of course, on the internet, you can check us out at stonebarnscenter.org. and really see the schedule of all of our events and things that are going on. Really, the site offers all kinds of information about our training program, about volunteering, and links to all sorts of other interesting things. You can also check us out on YouTube. There's a lot of short videos about the farm. It's been great to have social media out there, keeping it live and interesting, and our whole team of young folks are all engaged in that stuff. So Instagram, Facebook, Stone Barn Center, check it out.
Very good. We can live vicariously through that, right? And just even in the off season, get to experience some of that.
And, you know, of course, if you are ever visiting New York City or Westchester, this area in southern New York, Hudson Valley, we are right outside of Tarrytown, which is about a 35-minute train ride from Grand Central Station and a 5-minute taxi ride. So we're very close to the city. If you're ever there, come up for a day. We're open Wednesday through Sunday, and farmers are here every day of the week.
I think for many, it's, you know, we go out to Napa, or we go to Europe, we go to France, we go to Italy, and you experience that. It's part of the cuisine, the experiences to immerse yourself in that, and you learn some, you taste, you enjoy. And I think that's absolutely what we get here, and to be able to then come and engage with the experts that you have here, the real thought leaders in the space of the future of regenerative agriculture is an exciting opportunity. So Jack Algier, I can't thank you so enough for partaking in Sourcing Matters today. It was a wonderful conversation, and until next time, I'll say.
Thank you very much, Aaron.